Okay, I think we'll get started. This is Walking Through the Valley Together, Hour Two, Helping Our Friends, Family, and Patients Face Cancer. I'm Tom Bracken. I think everybody's been here before, am I right? So I won't give a lengthy biography. Hour Two is going to be about helping during cancer treatment. And rather than starting with a prayer today, I'm going to start with a song by St. Marty of Haugen. Just the first verse. It'll be all right. Down 35W in Minneapolis on the way to work one day, just tears running down my face listening to that. God remembers pain. And of course what he's saying is that God had pain once. God remembers joy, taste of food. I was thinking about this last night. We were on the porch drinking wine. And I usually don't like to drink here. I feel like I don't need alcohol. Sometimes at home I need alcohol. But it just seemed like the right thing to do. We were sharing it with friends, and I was actually thinking about how God, Jesus, had sat down, I'm sure, enjoyed a glass of wine. God remembers us, all we were, all we are. Death will take us all, but in eternal love, every life is now. And they're very comforting words. The words are by Brian Wren, and the album is Turn My Heart by Marty Haugen. It's in the bookstore. It was written for the thick times, as Bob Sorensen put it, between the times, the times when God seems silent, but it's very faith-inspiring. So, first part of this will be a little medical-oriented, and the last part will be less medical, this is an important part of what happens when you look at cancer. The first time that you realize it and it's been evaluated and you kind of know how bad it is or isn't and what are you going to do about it. And I suppose that most people go for conventional treatments. Surgery, chemo, radiation, interferon, freezing, marrow transplantation. The men that go through prostate cancer, you know, you can have a radical prostatectomy, you can have cryotherapy where they freeze the thing, you can have radiation from the outside, you can have these radiation seeds placed. It's bewildering for that particular treatment. It can be the same, could be true for breast. My best friend's wife that has breast cancer got two completely different opinions from oncologists as to what she had to do. She's still working on it. So that can be difficult for people. The other thing that you have that confuses people is adjunctive. Adjunct means something that helps. Conventional treatment that supplements the mainstay of cancer treatment. So you have colon cancer, and after you're done, they say, well, we think you need some chemo. Where did you cure it? You mostly cured it, if you did, with the surgery. That's, you know, probably 80% of what you accomplished, but you can lower the death rate and the relapse rate by about 20% by going through chemo. That's really not too bad. People certainly look into alternative therapy. Who's a famous person? Suzanne Summers, I think she had breast cancer. And I think she had regular surgery, but then went through alternative adjunct treatment. So she, herbs, and I'm not sure what she did, but she's been on television talking about it. So that would be complementary treatment, where you you add something to conventional treatment. I see that more often than I see people saying, I'm just going to Mexico.
Get gold shots?
You know, gold shots actually did work for rheumatoid arthritis.
Right.
But nobody knew how they worked, and we really don't. We have such better medicines. They were effective, and they weren't expensive. I'm trying to think if they looked like gold. I think they did.
That wouldn't work if it was on tequila, would it?
Well, yeah. There's an oral form. So some of the alternative treatments that we use are diet, nutrition, magnetic fields. There's whole systems. Gershon, is that the name of it? Gorsh. Pharmacologic therapies, touch therapy, herbal medicines, mind and body techniques, and I don't know where you put prayer in here. Prayer can be anything from adjunctive to alternative to complementary. And I've had people that said, no, I'm not going to do anything about this, I'm just going to pray. Christian Scientists, some of them do that.
We have a church in Portland that has had several deaths of young children because they refused to let them have treatment.
Oregon City.
We just had a huge one in Minnesota that went to the Minnesota Supreme Court. A young boy, was he 15, and they joined this religious sect after he got sick with Hodgkin's. Hodgkin's is 98% curable in the stage he had it, even though it's a pretty big tumor. And the Supreme Court said that his parents could not decide, he could not decide. He became a ward of the state, and they made him go to Children's Hospital and have treatment. And he went in remission, he's fine. And now here's the bizarre thing, his father has lymphoma.
Really?
Kind of the same illness. It had to do with, they wanted to do nutritional therapy. Now they did do that, they took the nutritional therapy. But, so now his father has the same illness. And I think they fell away, I'm not sure if they fell away from that religion. It was tied into Native American spiritualities. It didn't make sense to me at all.
In Oregon, there's jail sentences and court orders.
Now, because the legislature passed a law
for
just recently regarding, because there were so many children in this particular, they only believed in prayer. And they had so many children die that now they've actually sentenced a couple people to jail for not taking care of their, getting their kids to some medical treatment. And they took a baby away, the made a ward of the state now.
We've had outbreaks of illness in the Amish communities that wouldn't have immunizations in the southern part of Minnesota.
is wonderful, but if God give you, gives you the answer in medicine or a doctor, I see no reason not to accept.
Yeah. So I advise people to let their doctors know about alternative complementary treatments, because they can change what we do. Some of what we do has to work on, it's working on nutrition, for instance, the treatment for colon cancer, if I wasn't here, I'd know the name of it. It's a vitamin D analog. And if you take a lot of vitamins, you can block it. So many cancer treatments interfere with natural processes. So if you augment the natural processes, you could be fighting what your doctor does. Now, I can't tell you what to do, but I want to know, especially your oncologist wants to know. So this fits into what we were just saying. Who decides? Well, here's where your sources of information are. Your family doctor, your oncologist. Really encourage people with non-regular things to get second opinions. I mean, important things. Third opinions, fourth opinions. Friends and family. American Cancer Society has a website. Mayo Clinic has a great website. You don't have to live in Minnesota. You just go to mayoclinic.com. And they have very reliable information. I actually work with a doctor at the Indian Reservation who uses a lot of complementary treatments, so he's a resource for me to know this person's in all these things, what are they really doing, and what are they? A lot of times we don't know what they are. I'll have people that have a kind of a straightforward cancer. They have colon cancer, and it looks like it hasn't spread, and they say, Doc, do you think I should go to the Mayo Clinic, which is supposedly the mecca for everything? Interestingly, and I'm going to talk about him later next week, they have some outstanding oncologists that are very down to earth and great in Holden, especially Ed Cregan. I'm going to talk about him when I address the subject of caregivers caring for themselves. But I tell them, you know, I think at home with your family doctors and your local hospitals do a better job at the more routine things. They do them more often. They're used to it. And then you have better communication. I only send people to Mayo Clinic for big things, unless they want to go, and then they go, and they get good care there. I'm always surprised at people that just put it in my hands, or the oncologist, or the surgeon's hand, and they don't read a word about it. The same people that read Consumer's Report before they buy a car. I do. Before I buy a car, I go get that auto issue, figure it out, and read manuals. I read surveys, but I'm surprised that people have something this important, they don't look into it. My dad didn't even talk to me about his cancer surgery when he had cancer. And I'm also surprised that they don't ask about what is this treatment doing. If anyone wasn't here, this is my mother who died of colon cancer 17 years ago, which made me a lot better doctor. And the doctor just said, well, how about some chemo? She said, okay. And she had the first course, which really didn't help her. It didn't make her very sick. And when that didn't work, he said, how about some more chemo? She said, okay. That made her a little sicker, and she was hospitalized a time or two. It did affect her eyes. Her eyes became very dry, and the one thing she had left that she could really enjoy was reading. It kind of took away that enjoyment for her. I don't think it really extended her life. And people should ask, you know, what is the survival rate with this? What is the survival rate without this? I told you yesterday about a young girl in our community that has a neuroblastoma, and she became ill when I was at Holden here in 2006, and she's still alive and fighting. At the same time, we have a 19-year-old who has a nerve cell tumor. They took it off his spine, and they said, you know, this is a bad actor. It's probably going to come back. And it has come back. He has spread throughout his lungs. And so they told him about the chemotherapy, and they said, there's a 20% chance he'll respond. And he said, nope, I'm going to stay home and enjoy my girlfriend. But I think I probably got one good summer left, and I'm not going to do it sick. He has strong Christian faith. I don't know if it'd be any different if he didn't have faith. And his sister, who I work with very frequently, comes to work with a smile on her face. I think that is partially because of their faith. So when I send people off, I usually ask them, find out what your rates of cure, response, and side effects are of major things. when it's a last-ditch effort, you really got to think about it, and it's so dependent what your oncologist is like. And I kind of know, I've picked the ones that I know will communicate, and that's who I send people to. And as we talked to yesterday, it depends on your coping style. Some people can't cope with information. Just tell me what to do. All right, then I have more responsibility. Any thoughts on that? I'm going to talk a little bit. This reminds me of what Kit said when he said he wasn't going to give a fair report about Saudi Arabia. He obviously is very upset about what happens in Saudi Arabia. And I've been mostly upset about so-called unconventional treatment.
You're prejudiced against it.
Yeah. Now, I don't necessarily say that in the exam room. I will direct them. I don't necessarily say, well, we could do conventional or unconventional. I may not even bring it up, but if they bring it up and they say they're going to do it, one thing I make sure is that they realize I'm not going to reject them for doing it. You don't have to take my advice and everything. You can come back. I'll help you at any time. This isn't, you're not rejecting me by taking this treatment. But many unconventional treatment centers, you'll get a brochure and they emphasize anecdotal reports. They have patients that, you know, I had cancer all over, I took this treatment, now they say there's no cancer at all. The same has been said of prayer. And their terminal cancer has been miraculously cured by this, whatever this treatment is. We had a series of these in Minnesota. In fact, they probably wanted to build one in Onamia, this cancer treatment place. I'm trying to think of the name of it. I can't think of it offhand. They got into trouble with the state board. On the other hand, conventional treatments will tell you, well, we did a study and we did 10,000 breast cancer patients and 63.4% did this way and 23.5% did this. And they'll show you there are modest improvement in survival rates over nothing. They're subject to analysis and peer review. And some of the treatments are pretty small effects. I'm always impressed by the stuff in journals where you'll see this curve, and here's the one curve, and the other curve is just a little bit off, and they'll say, yeah, this worked on this cancer. Well, boy, it gave them, you know, 14 days or something. But that's how they make progress, by entering people into large studies. A couple things to consider with this. Parker Hughes Institute, that's the name of the place in St. Paul, just closed. There's a small but real rate of spontaneous remissions of cancers. 1 out of 500 will just go away. The body fights them. As I mentioned yesterday, we fight cancer all the time. Our immune system fights it off. Usually when it's not spread markedly, but we do see things that look miraculous. C.S. Lewis, his wife, had cancer in her bone, and he was sure she was going to die, and very much felt they had a miracle, and perhaps read that. And he wrote a book called Surprised by Joy, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then when she died a few years later, he wrote a book that's just dark, A Grief Observed. I've seen people when the light just goes out of their eyes. I don't know if you saw Carla Miller-Paul when her husband died, when Oscar died.
Yeah.
And she went from this vivacious, fun woman, she was just dead for quite a while. And other people, they managed to just keep walking, and you can never predict. I didn't think it would be so hard for her, but just terrible. Now she's fine again. So if a non-conventional center has 500 patients, they'll have at least one to put in their brochure, and they get thousands. But if you add that 1 out of 500 to the conventional treatment, it doesn't make much difference in those statistics. So that's why these places have brochures. My personal experience, I had a patient not long ago had a lung tumor this big in their lung. Eccentric people. Okay to take care of. The husband was extremely attentive to the wife. but in weird ways. And he went to Parker Hughes, and I never heard a thing from them. He told me they were treating her. It had to do with diet and enemas. And they never communicated with me, and the Parker Hughes Center didn't. And as the years went on, that tumor just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, when it was just about the width of her lung, he got her enrolled in cancer treatment. He got a biopsy, and of course it was way too late. And when the poor thing died, he thought maybe it was because the nurses gave her the dose of medicine too early that night. She took blood pressure medicine, the same stuff I take. And he was pretty concerned that maybe that is what killed her, rather than seeing the obvious. The unconditional centers, in my experience, didn't follow up on side effects of medication. Someone had a fast heartbeat. Well, they had a fast heartbeat because they were anemic and they put her on heart medicine. Their medicine had made them anemic. They should have fixed that. They gave them cortisone high doses. We had a patient came back from Mexico in very high doses of prednisone, and it eventually actually killed them.
Wouldn't any common sense patient ask his own trusted physician what he thought about these treatments?
I think we've all met people that trust the kind of...
the PR.
They trust the out of the ordinary much more than they trust anybody regular. Amateur-oriented people, like, it's got to be organic.
You have to be an expert in real estate at least 150 miles away to come into town and be an expert.
Yeah.
The guy that's worked there all his life may not understand the city. Well, okay.
I love this one, and it kind of fits with faith healing. Patients were told ahead of time if they failed treatment, it's because they weren't adhering to the prescribed regimen strictly enough. I had a gentleman that died of colon cancer, and of course it kept on getting bigger and bigger. All he needed was surgery, but he wouldn't do it. And they wanted him to drink grapefruit juice, and he thought grape juice would be good enough. But he went back, they said, you're not strict enough. If you were strict enough, then this would be shrinking. They told him at first it was shrinking, and he believed it. I can't see how it ever could have. And we also hear this. The reason that they won't use our treatment is because doctors don't want to believe in this because they would lose money. They have so much money tied up in this. And if you pick up, you can see them in the airport on the way home. If you pick up a book out of the bookstore, they'll have at least one new treatment that will say, you know, this is great information we're getting to you. In fact, if you sign up, we'll send you more. But doctors don't want you to know this.
The secrets, doctors.
So I'm not happy about some of these places. One thing we're really doing better with is symptom control. I think of my poor fella, it wasn't cancer, it was emphysema that died. Gosh, if I could take care of him now, I could have made him so much more comfortable. Using medicines we've had, so I think the main change in the last 20 or 30 years is attitude. But we have better medication, we have better technology, and we can really commit to people, I'm going to keep you comfortable. It doesn't mean it's easy. I showed my list yesterday of the 100 or so patients I have helped through the death from cancer, and I've learned from most of them, especially the ones that are longer and harder. We have better pain medication. We use a lot more than when I started practice. These patches are great. We have these nerve medicines which really help. The delivery systems, when I started, it was rare to see any of this. You didn't have patches. Patches are wonderful. You don't have to take pills. You don't have to worry about whether you're nauseated. They're very strong. PICC lines and central lines and ports, where if you're going to have extended treatment, they put a thing about as big as a, is it like a thing you keep your dental floss in, and it goes underneath your skin here, and they can automatically start an IV without starting an IV. I believe in God, but I think the greatest argument against God is that it's hard to start IVs.
Her rolling veins.
Yeah, and some people just don't have any. My poor little partner's daughter, If she had had to have IVs all this time, 4 years, she's way out of veins. So they can draw blood, they can put anything, put blood in there, and it lasts for years. They're just absolutely wonderful. We have some new techniques. We have these epidural catheters like they use in labor to help any pain from butt your chest down. Nerve blocks, they do blocks for pancreas cancer. They make a big difference. We have new medicines for nausea. Zofran was the first one. It was real expensive at first, but now it's cheap. And they work much better than Compazine and some of the things we used to have. Antidepressants help. We have long-acting Valium, Clonopin. Then there's this whole issue of terminal sedation. I kind of did this with a patient not too long ago. And what you do is, of course, you're treating their pain, but you give them something like Valium. We actually use Versed or Ativan, that puts them to sleep. Not to sleep like you could operate on them, but they fall asleep. And every so often, they'll wake up for a while. And when they say, oh boy, it's really starting to get to me, you put them back to sleep. And there's a point at which you say, we're not going to worry about whether you're eating. We're not going to worry about whether you're hydrated. We're just going to worry about whether you're comfortable. That's a tough place to get to sometimes. It's hard to know when you're going down this, and you're deteriorating, but when are you going down a slippery slope? And a good physician's going to always wonder if I could have gotten a little longer. But there's a point at which they're just, you know, it's hopeless as far as saving their life long term, and you decide to let them go.
But don't we have, as patients, responsibility to make that decision
for
our loved ones in the the paper you fill out that says
sure.
You have the, if I can't make decisions.
Yeah, living will.
And there was a government thing where you had to counsel, they were going to have, you have to counsel somebody if you pulled the plug, basically.
That was part of the
Medicare,
the healthcare reform. I think it might have been a little more rhetoric from the people against it, but I don't know what happened.
Knowing you kind of personally, as we sort of do, I'm sure that you counsel the consult with these people, talk to them, pray with them, whatever, to make these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Pastors often do, doctors often do. Sometimes your lawyers even talk to you, or your accountant.
You know, we don't get that very often, and I've never had to take a living will and show it to a judge or a lawyer. It really helps when it's obvious to me as a physician, you know, person's had a stroke, they're 92, they're not going to wake up again. Really doesn't make sense to be feeding them or whatever it is we're thinking about doing. And there's a living will that supports that. If anything, it most often it helps ease the minds of the people that are making the decision they had to make anyway.
Have you seen a living will that says, I want you to go to the ends of the earth and keep me alive as long as possible, no matter what?
Oh, I've got a 92-year-old in a nursing home now that's got renal failure and kidney failure, and we're going to have some discussion about whether she really wants to go on dialysis. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, then you have other situations. My cousin was diagnosed with terminal cancer, I mean, stage 4, as soon as they diagnosed it.
Young person?
Is that?
Young person?
He'd have been 40. He'd have been 40 tomorrow. But yeah, he died in 9 weeks. From the time he was diagnosed to the time he passed, it was, I mean, he just dropped out. I mean, it wasn't even a question of living will or anything like that.
There's kind of a notion that everybody, if you don't have a do not resuscitate order, you're obligated to resuscitate them. But gosh, a 95-year-old that just had a bad heart attack and their heart's failing, it makes no sense. And there are times when we just don't. But
has your judgment ever been questioned? Well, I guess you answered.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Not to a legal point. We quit CPR on a guy that had been, you know, we live in an ice fishing resort area. They pulled him out from the ice, and he'd been underneath for an hour. Some of the ambulance crew thought, we worked for 2 hours. They thought we should work for longer. But it was just, he wasn't going to say that. No point to it. The one that really just got to me, I had a guy that had some mildly elevated liver tests. He was very obese. And I did some tests. maybe something's wrong with his liver. I did an MRI. We're not sure. Did another one. Yeah, we think there's something wrong. He had liver cancer, primary liver cancer. It started there. I really worked hard to get him into Mayo Clinic to see if they could remove it and do a transplant. They said, no, we can't. They didn't say, no, we can't. They said, he's a class D, which means you'll never get you'll never get through the list. So, well, we didn't give up there. We sent him to the university. How about you guys? Would you take it out and do a transplant? Finally, this was a good friend of mine from high school. I finally had to call him. What happened with that? Oh, we decided he's a class D. Well, thanks for telling me and him. So, he's incurable. And I saw him every so often. And that's one thing I do with terminal cancer patients. I see him every month, whether or not they need anything, just so they feel like I'm in touch with them. And I said, are you telling your wife about this? Does she realize, you know, that things are getting worse and, you know, your time is limited? Oh, yeah, I'm sure she knows that. We've had some talks. Well, he finally came in unconscious and died. And she thought maybe it was because the guy put the tube into his stomach. It's a long story. She thought maybe that killed him. Of course, it didn't. Then she made an appointment to see me. Occasionally, people want to just sit down and hash it out. And she said, yeah, I just wanted to let you know I thought you didn't do a good job. Gosh, I had done a lot of work. I remember once getting all their reports together. They were going another place and walked across town to where she worked and gave it to them and made sure they had everything they needed. And yeah, you didn't tell him what to eat. If you had told him what to eat, he never really got good dietary advice. He would have lived. And, you know, my left side of my brain knows that she just didn't have a way to cope with this. And she had to blame somebody. I suspect she blamed other people. But I took the brunt of it on that. And it didn't make me feel bad intellectually, but emotionally it really bothered me.
A lot of people blame themselves for their friends or their partners or their acquaintance. So.
I had somebody... somebody killed himself a couple months ago, right after they had a fight with their spouse. And she came in and blamed all of us. And they had just had a fight, and she had said rude things to him.
You know, the living will, how important that is, having just gone through dealing with the living will within the last week and a half.
I forgot, was it your mother, Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right there, you know, I had this document, and it gave me this authority to make these decisions, and it was so helpful to have that. But I had so much help from doctors and from hospice and from family that it was kind of what you were saying, that it became a compilation, that we all agreed this is what has to happen. But having that document was... I can't tell you how good it felt to have that that legal authority and everything. So I hope what I would say to other people is, if you know, if you haven't taken care of this stuff, man, take care of it and have it everything all done ahead of time.
Yeah, that really helps.
Yeah.
Tom, Jeannie differentiates between and maybe it's just Iowa, a living will and power of attorney. And
oh, that's a big difference.
Her argument is that a living will really isn't as effective.
A durable power of attorney, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah, a durable power of attorney means that if you are unable to make decisions for yourself, the other person can make decisions on all sorts of things. All your finances, your will, your investments, your property. The living will only tells us who your proxy is for your health care decisions. So it's kind of a power of attorney, but just for health care decisions.
And a normal,
it gives you guidelines.
Normal power of attorney ends when that person dies.
Right.
So
a durable power of attorney continues after that.
Yes, right.
So is it like naming executor of the state? Executor of the state?
I don't think it necessarily makes you an executor of their state.
Oh, okay.
That would be in your will.
Yeah.
Or the court decides.
So we never, as I mentioned earlier, I've never taken a living will has never gone to a judge or a court or a lawyer. Powers of attorney have. And the thing that surprises me sometimes, you know, there's five kids, and oldest son should be the no, I don't want him. He doesn't make good decisions. He gets everybody irritated, and they pick certain people. Like my dad picked two of his kids and not the third. I think the best improvement in care has been for patients and doctors to openly discuss their concern and make a treatment plan. And I think in Japan there's still a tendency to not tell patients the diagnosis. You don't want to let them know they have cancer. They know, you know, but you don't talk about it. How could you possibly make any progress doing that? Well, we got ahead of ourselves a little bit on final decisions.
I suppose there are people that wouldn't want their loved ones to know, too, to save them the grief.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
Why don't you just pretend you never died? If he's of cancer that's not talked that much about is facing the decision to stop treatment, when do you say, you know, I'm tired, I've had enough? It's going to be a very, very uncomfortable time, especially if the patient, family, or caregivers are dishonest, I mean, about their cancer, or refuse to face the decision. Times that have improved and that patients and doctors are more willing to look at this openly, honestly, and together. Still, some patients and some doctors go through failed treatment after failed treatment without facing the inevitable. One of the wise oncologists that wrote the books I did some research on for these talks worked with when he was in training with a senior oncologist. And he noticed that whenever stuff started to go sour, and it does in a big percentage of patients, the senior guy wasn't around. He couldn't face time to patients. He liked it when they were getting better. He liked being the hero, but boy, if they were going downhill, he just quit seeing them. I told you yesterday about Dr. Newland's brother, but I'm also going to tell you about Dr. Groupman's colleague, because I don't want this for me to be easy. I usually find myself wishing they'd quit. I'm not sure why. I'm aware of that tendency. You know, I've got a cancer that's spread. It's all over. I wish they would quit treatment and desperately putting themselves through it and deal with what they have. But Dr. Groupman, who wrote this really good cancer book, had a colleague who was a physician. He was a pathologist, and he got cancer of the stomach. And when they did a CT scan, they could see it was in the lymph nodes. Prognosis for recovery for that is about 2% survival at 5 years. And he figured, well, this pathologist is going to know that. You know, maybe some easy chemo, maybe a little radiation, but he's not going to treat this aggressively. Well, the guy was a Christian, too. He had strong faith in life after this. And the guy went through every treatment. And nobody wanted to operate on him. It's really hard to operate after you've had radiation, but he wanted surgery, and he talked somebody into it. They were all mad about that. And they went in after he'd had the chemo and the radiation, and they took his stomach out, and by golly, he was cured. And he had a long-term remission. And he finally went up to say to him, you know, why did you do this? Surely you knew that you were likely to die from this tumor. He said, yeah, I knew that. But my wife really wanted to be around, and I thought I got nothing. He says, I knew that if I died either way, it's like, I love that song we sang at prayer around the cross. First heard it in this room, if we live, we live in the Lord. If we die, we die in the Lord. So whether we die or whether we live, we are the Lord's. I think, what's the guy's name? The guy that was registrar here. Rolf. Yeah. It's beautiful. So, I'm wrong this way or that way. People die quicker than I think they'll die, and they live longer than I think they live, and you have to kind of roll with the punches and let patients make the decision. There are cancers that really deserve a fight. This adjuvant chemo is really worth it. I had somebody that decided, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm just not going to get sick. I've suffered enough. And actually, they weren't that old. I had an 85-year-old lady with cancer not long ago, and she's got a little dementia. We're not going to give her adjuvant chemo. She's not going to be alive when she's 90. Adjuvant chemo is for what happens in 3-5 years. Cancer hasn't spread or invaded organs. Fight that. Leukemias, lymphomas, myeloma are almost always worth a fight, often cure them. There's some tumors we don't cure. Solid tumors that have spread to your liver or bone, distant areas, not too likely. There's a few exceptions, choriocarcinoma, which is a tumor of the placenta. It's easier to cure than strep throat. It grows really fast, so our chemo can just wipe it out. I've never seen it. Tumors that have failed several modes of treatment, and I mean failed, nothing's worked. Although the hormone areas, breast, prostate, ovarian, you just keep throwing medicine at them and they just keep surviving. We just had a lady in my hometown that died after 10 years of ovary treatment. Very productive, wonderful life. She knew it the whole time. Prostate can go for an awfully long time. In fact, you can kind of just keep it at bay like a peat bog fire. And then, like this, my friend's daughter has had hers for 4 years. I think she'll live for some longer time. They've tried this treatment for breast cancer where they really hit you hard in an attempt to wipe out the breast cancer, then give you bone marrow transplant. That has not increased breast cancer survival. Advanced lung cancer is usually not cured. Lung cancer is terrible. Smoking is absolutely horrible. I mentioned yesterday that I've seen twice as much of that as anything else I've seen. But I've seen some cures. I have a native friend who's had a tumor this big in his lung, and we took it out, sent him out to have it taken out 15 years ago, and he's fine. And he will be fine with that. He quit smoking. He also quit drinking. Wonderful man. Good friend. Only 1 out of 5 lung cancers, after you evaluate them, are they able to be removed. They've not spread. And only half of one of those do they actually have a long-term cure. There is this small cell cancer of the lung, which is a different animal, and it spreads really fast. By the time you find it, even if it's small, it's spread. We sometimes cure that with chemo and radiation. It's kind of a funny thing when that happens. I have a young guy, I think he's young, he's 2 years older than me, come to think of it. He's a rock and roller. He played bass in rock and roll bands in Minneapolis all his life, and he's been cured. And he's surprised as heck, and he feels a little guilty about it. It's hard for him to cope with it. So, facing death, we played Marty's beautiful song. We all have to die sometime. This is Dominic, 75-year-old man with metastatic colon cancer, no doubt gone by now. I just happen to know a little more about how and when my death will be. Gives you time to plan and take care of things. Dr. Newland, in his book, talked about 2 deaths. One was a death like this, a younger person. A person about the same age, early 50s, that died suddenly of a stroke. Which is better? There's quite a bit of debate. I don't know. You don't get to pick. Is the answer to the question, which is better. But at least when you're dying from cancer, you have time to say some things to people, get some things in order. I know a lot of you have probably read Tuesdays with Maury. It's a great book. The 5 people you meet in heaven is not a great book. Anybody read that? Did you like that poem? I just hated it.
And I loved Tuesdays with Maury.
Did you?
Yeah.
You and I agree on most books. Yeah. We've had a couple of big disagreements. He said, I become interesting to people. People see me as a bridge. I'm not alive as I used to be, but I'm not dead yet. I'm sort of in between. I'm on the last journey here. And people want me to tell them what to pack. I like that. We had a couple patients that, one religious guy in Onamia. Did you ever know Bevan Rod Neeson? He was a logger. And when he was dying, his wife said, what do you see? He said, I see Jesus. And she just thought that he was looking right at Jesus. I've had also 2 patients that had one of these things where they died and came back. And Jesus said, no, you're not done yet. We have a coroner for the several counties, and she wrote a book of people that had experiences like that. Very interesting experiences. The one was a kid out in California, and he got up in the morning and said, where's Grandpa? What do you mean? Well, where's Grandpa's here, isn't he? No. Well, I was talking with him last night, and of course, Grandpa just died. So if that stuff happens, I wonder why it doesn't happen more predictably or often. Sir William Osler, one of the most famous physicians in history. Most people die as they lived, some with metaphysical and religious concerns on their minds, other in the everyday preoccupations they always have had. And when my mom died, that was it. You know, she wanted to talk about her flowers. I talked with her. A week before she died, we had our last really good talk, and we talked about the flowers and the gardens and what birds were coming, and she did not have a, you know, you've been a great son or whatever. We did not have that kind of talk. So entering the phase of terminal illness is not just stopping treatment or stopping living. It's a new, even a final stage of life that can be traveled well or traveled poorly. There's four issues you have to face: physical, pain and other symptoms, psychological. I don't see people freak out too much or get really angry. Sadness, anxiety, sometimes depression. Social, facing separation, planning for family. I've seen a lot of that. When Rich Mucha died, knew he had leukemia and he wouldn't survive, and he said, "You got to take care of Marion." And Marion ended up, she was a spunky little thing. She ended up in the nursing home, and I made sure I looked after her. She didn't need much, she just needed somebody to visit her. I did that. Death ends a life, not that life's relationships. And Jeannie talked yesterday about the spiritual end, reaching out to a higher power. So what can we do to help? Anybody here hospice volunteers? That's one wonderful thing you can do. Another wonderful thing, by gosh, I don't have my bracelet on today. The bracelets that people wear, our old town, you go to communion, there's probably 8 out of 10 have a bracelet. In fact, I got a little bit of, lost a little bit of tan from it for the young lady that's dying in our community, or ill in our community. And Caring Bridge, you've all been in Caring Bridge, familiar? You're not familiar with Caring Bridge? Caring Bridge is an absolute blessing. CaringBridge.org. It's not just for cancer. One of my friend's daughters died of leukemia about 10 years ago. Caring Bridge is a website, and I believe it's free of charge to you. They take donations from people. And it's a website where the family can say, well, you know, Mary's having a good day today, or counts her up, we think she's going to get out of room 117 today. And then you can send them notes, so you don't have to call. When my friend's daughter was dying, I thought, geez, should I call them? I bet they're busy, you know. I wonder if I can get through. this way you can know what's going on. Vast amounts of people can know. And then they can also hear from you. We just had in Minnesota, there's a deputy that was shot a while ago, and now he's in the process of dying from what happened from that. And he's got a Caring Bridge site. It's just absolutely a wonderful blessing. So, if you can clarify the issues for patients and loved ones, for doctors, make sure you're available to them. Give them your home number, your cell number now. Make sure families know who they can call. Mentioned yesterday, my dad did not know what to do. Death usually doesn't come abruptly, but gradually you usually can see it coming. Although I'm terribly wrong sometimes. I went to visit, I do home visits mostly with dying patients, not very often. They are so grateful. I don't do a darn thing. I don't write a prescription usually. I examine them just so they feel like it really happened, but they just feel so comforted knowing that a doctor came and cared and that I'd be there because they're wondering what's going to happen. But usually they just they stop having bodily functions and they go to sleep. But I'm there if they need them. I went to visit one lady that was dying she had melanoma, an elderly lady, and she hadn't talked to him in a day, and she had that deep breathing, and she'd stop every so often. And I said, well, she's probably going to die within the next day or so, and her suffering's over. We're still suffering, but she's at peace now. And she woke up and said, well, hi, Dr. Bracken. Oh, gosh. Yeah, she did. Not the last time. And we usually don't have these deathbed scenes like you see in the movies. The movies really get it wrong. So you got to take your, if you want to say something, people ask me, should I come and should I come now? And I say, well, there's three things you could come for. One is if there's something you really want to say. Or if you think you want to be there to hold their hand as they die. Or if they need you for something. And if they don't really need you right now, no, I don't think she's going to die really quickly. If there's something you haven't said, well, you need to come now because it could happen any time. And it is nice to have someone holding their hand when they die, but what's really important is not that. It's what you did the last how many years you've had together. And a lot of patients, we try to have somebody with them when they die, hospice volunteer or someone, but it's not always at the exact moment. Jeannie talked about God yesterday. It depends what you share with them. I certainly have never tried to convert anybody on their deathbed. And Jeannie said she wants to listen to hear where they are with God. And the way this book said, a true helper doesn't offer a new system or change your beliefs, but says here, I'm here to help you find your own meaning. Make the final connections. They give away possessions. Plan the funeral. Enjoy what you enjoyed before. Food, wine, song, favorite places. Have an ordinary day. And I have a portion of my living will right here. Do not go playing How Great Thou Art at my bedside when I'm dying on the organ. I want the Beatles. I want Lyle Lovett. I want Bill Staines. I do want Marty Hogan. He's going to have to be part of it. And most importantly, tell them you love them. Spend time with them. Just stay in the room with them. Tell them you'll always remember them. Pray with them and for them. Now that I told you about my friend's daughter dying, or not dying, but she was quite ill with her first bone marrow transplant, almost died with it. And her mom and dad were up with her day and night. They didn't sleep 3 hours in a row for 2 weeks. It was just hellacious. She just had another one, which was a lot smoother for her. But we play this song in church with our Lent service, and Patty said this is what got her through. I'm just going to, it's good to have something in your mind that you can kind of sing to yourself. It's off the same album. Let's see if I can get it to do it. No.
Raise your voice.